accession number 18776, rail 7.
Well, we were just talking about Roger Curry, I think, who was, I think, certainly 41, 42, who was deemed to be too old. But I think by dint of a bit of wangling, we managed to include him in. He was determined to do his bit. Well, Roger was, I think, as I say, much too old for our sort of activity. But nevertheless, he performed. He was a administrative officer. He did a marvellous job, and he managed to, I think he was evacuated just before the end, actually, but he came through with flying colours, you might say. It was a great tribute. There was another chap I remember who was a Rhodesian, who also was, I think, had been in the First World War, who was aged 40 or 41, and he was actually looking after the mules in our sister column, number 12, and he, again, was far older than most of us, but he came through it with flying colours. So I'm only saying that it makes the point that some of the oldies were just as capable of staying the course, as some of the younger members. And again, the other contrast one sometimes has in mind, I know that our intelligence officer was a little chap called Alan Brander. Well, if you'd seen Alan Brander, you'd have thought that he was the last person to be anything like a guerrilla, the last man to be involved in guerrilla-type activities. Alan Brander was, in fact, a bank clerk from, I think, Stoke-on-Trent. And he was a little short chap. He had a great sense of humour, which I'm sure helped him enormously. And he was undaunted, gutty little man, but he was a bit tubby, and he wasn't really athletic in any sense. And he was, you would have thought, if you'd been hand-picking, he was probably the last chap you would have picked for anything like this. But it turned out that he was a brave chap, really, in a quiet way, unassuming and modest, but was always able to put a slight twist, humorous twist on anything that happened. An optimist, I suppose you would say, which is probably what helped keep him going. But I often thought that sometimes the most unlikely people turn out to be your really staunch men on whom you could put complete trust, reliance, and what have you. And so it's difficult really to decide sometimes how people will stand up to the tests they're put to in times of stress. Unlikely characters, and there are others too one can think of, unlikely people who suddenly came to the fore and were enormous sources of strength when all around was disintegrating and falling about. We have kept up our reunion, incidentally, until recently at least. We had about every second or third year we had a little lunch party, and we started about 16 of us who have been together more or less. And I think we're down to about four now, something like that. Four or five left. So we're slightly restricted by numbers.
But you were saying earlier about the martial nature of the soldiers that you recruited to be riflemen in the Nigeria regiment, and how they were picked instead of the people from the south. But at the same time, the British officers you've just been talking about people who were working in banks and this type of thing, and yet who performed well. So was it really necessary to have the martial tribes only as riflemen, do you think?
Well, I don't think I said that the Hausamen from the north were martial men. I didn't mean to imply that. I don't think they would say that. I think they would say they were farmers, probably. Horsemen, farmers, and so on. They had a tribal, I suppose they had a martial streak in them. They were all horsemen. They all knew how to operate a lance, for instance. And there is this marvellous ceremony I think they still carry out today at Kano, where the Emir of Kano stands outside the gates, and about 30 horsemen, who are all minor chiefs, do this amazing cavalry charge with a lance bared and pointing at the the Emir of Kano, who stands facing them, and they do this charge over about 100 yards, flat out, all, as it were, pointing at the Emir. And then suddenly, at the last moment, they draw up about 15 yards short. And the great clouds of dust and the horses are pulled back. This is a sort of token of obeisance, of loyalty. It's a ceremonial thing, which they do. But so there is a martial streak in them. But I don't know that it's true to say that they're warriors as such. But I think it's true to say that they make good warriors in the sense that they've got the Muslim faith, which probably helps them. And of course, they were, I think, very well trained by the British. But I wouldn't like to say they were necessarily a martial race as such. But going back to the point about the mixed lot of the Europeans, you see, what you've got to remember is it's a lot of these people who we went into Burma with. I was lucky in the sense that I went out as early as 1940, end of. So I was in it by the time I got anywhere near Burma, I was a pretty old hand. I was fluent in the language, I knew quite a lot about their traditions, customs, and so on. I was experienced, but some of the people who actually came in as reinforcements at a sort of fairly late stage, it only had 6 months, 9 months at the most with the African, in which time they'd had to learn the language, they had to learn the customs, had to attune themselves to the African way of life, and so on, which is not the same as the British necessarily. And so what I think one has to acknowledge and to respect is the way the British officer, and the British NCO as well, like your Sergeant Matthews I mentioned earlier, came out and suddenly adapted themselves. There was a very good book by a chap called James Shaw called The Long March Out, which it gives a very good account of that, because he came into the White City as a reinforcement. He'd been in Nigeria before that, I think, for a time, but he came out pretty green into the White City just in time for the March Out. That's why it's called, this book is called The March Out. He produced it shortly after the war, and it's actually written from the point of view of the sergeant in a machine gun platoon, which is what he was, and it's written from a very narrow viewpoint. It's a personal account from a necessarily narrow viewpoint, but nevertheless, it's very authentic in the sense that it's spontaneous, it's fresh, and it's a lot of it. I've read it recently because I've hardly bothered earlier on, but I've just, because of my recent research, been involved in looking at these things, and I've read, gone through it, and it rings very true indeed. It's a very good book.
I'm thinking of these savvy boys that you mentioned.
Yes, that's right.
Do you think they would have been able to perform?
Well, on the whole, I think most of them didn't come in, you see. They didn't. They were left behind, the clerks, if you like.
But if they had been, become riflemen, do you think they'd have been able to
perform as riflemen? That's an interesting question. I couldn't like to say. I don't know. I mean, there were some, I think, who suddenly got through of one reason or another and did become warriors, if you like, and probably did all right. So it's, to some extent, it's a question of the individual, isn't it? Like everything else, and individuals vary so much. But they're not really a warrior race. They weren't in the warrior tradition, if you like. They weren't recruited into the peacetime Nigeria regiment because they weren't seen to be the right people for that sort of role. The fighting tribesmen, as it were seen to come from the north, the Hausa speaking, which is one I talked about, which is what happened.
Now, can we go on to a different aspect of your career in the Malayan Emergency? Can you tell me when you came to be involved with that and in what capacity, please?
Ah, well, that's going on a bit, you see. By that time, that's well past the war. I went to Staff College in 1952, and at the end of that time, I was told that I'd been appointed to be Brigade Major of a brigade in Malaya, 63 Gurkha Brigade. And so early in 1953, I set sail, and we went out on a sea voyage in the way one did in those days, with family, and got to Singapore, and then went up country, and joined up with my brigade, reported to my brigade major, over my brigade commander, who was a celebrated character called Brigadier Henniker, CMA Henniker, known as Honker Henniker, who had a very Royal Engineer, in fact, but had a very distinguished war record, and who was also quite a well-known author. He's written several books, and used to be a regular contributor to a magazine that no longer exists called Blackwoods. Blackwoods magazine, which was what you might call Tales from Afar. And if you were serving anywhere overseas and you had a tale to tell about the colonies, the backwoods or whatever, you could write in to the editor of Blackwoods, who was a group captain, Algernon Blackwood, I think. But Blackwoods was a family journal, and if the article was deemed to be good enough, then you got yourself into print. And they're wonderful tales, actually, and if you can get hold of any old copies of Blackwoods, well, it's really... So he was a regular contributor to that, and some of them he did write tales from when he was out there. But anyway, he was a lovely man, and so I was very fortunate in having him as my brigade commander. So my job then was to really act, if you like, his sort of... his main staff officer and second in command in some respects. And so we had the Gurkhas, two battalions of Gurkhas, and we had one battalion of I think to start with, we had the Queen's Regiment, was it? Queen's Regiment? And then we had the 1st, 2nd Gurkha Rifles and the 2nd, 6th Gurkha Rifles. And a place, we were based in a place called Seremban in mid Malaya. Our job, basically, was to prosecute the war, if you like, against the communist terrorist regime, which was trying to take over Malaya. And we were, our task was to try and contain it and trying to re-establish confidence, if you like, in the civil population under the direction of General Templer. Now, General Templer, you see, had wore two hats. He was not only the commander-in-chief, as it were, out there, but he was also the governor. So he was the civil commander as well as the military commander. So that made life pretty easy when it came to decision-making. And he was very successful, of course, at it. But that went on for 2 years, and so I saw...
Which 2 years were those?
I was there, in fact. I took over in, I think it was March of 1953, and I handed over in March or April of 1955. So that was my lot, 2 years. But I was at not actually in a battalion of the Gurkhas, don't forget. I was at a brigade headquarters, where we had a brigade headquarters defense platoon, for example, of Gurkhas, and the drivers were all Gurkhas. I was surrounded by Gurkhas, in fact. And, of course, I saw a lot of the Gurkha battalions, so I got to know them, the Gurkhas and their officers and so on, very well. I never learned Gurkhali. I didn't really have to, and I didn't have the time, I suppose, or the incentive to study it. It wasn't really my role. But I did odd patrols from time to time, just to get the feel of the jungle again, just to see what was happening.
What was it like on patrol?
Well, I think it was very interesting. The British battalions were very good indeed. Ultimately, we moved down, in fact, from Seremban. My last station was a place called Moor, on the Moor River, which is just south of Malacca. And there we had a very interesting combination, in that we had the Queen's Regiment in Tampin, we had the 2nd, 6th Gurkha Rifles at Sagamet, and we had the Fiji Infantry Regiment, who were, I think they were at Moor. Anyway, you were interesting, because you had a British battalion, a Gurkha battalion, and a Fiji battalion. And they made a wonderful combination. They all had their different cultures and their different backgrounds and different approaches. But they were all equally successful in different ways. And it wasn't the Queen's. They'd gone. The Gordon Highlanders was the other battalion, Gordon Highlanders. So you had the Scotsmen. And you had the Fiji and you had the Gurkhas, and they made, as I say, interesting comparisons. They were all good at it in their own way. The Gordons, in fact, were not really, to be fair, cut out for that sort of operation. If you wanted to defend the White City, or if you wanted to defend Tobruk, or if you wanted to defend anything, I can imagine nothing better than to have a Gordon Highlander alongside you, because they would be superb. But when it came to operating in the jungle, I think perhaps they weren't quite so good at it. I don't mean to to deprecate the Gordons in any way. I'm merely saying that I don't think it was quite their best role. Now, the Gurkhas, of course, were the ones who had been sustaining. Don't forget, this campaign had started in about 48, 49. It had been going on for about 2 or 3 years when I got there. And the people who had been sustaining it were the Gurkhas and, to be fair, certain British battalions did remarkably well, like the Green Howards, for example. Some of the British battalions did remarkably well. The Fiji Infantry Regiment, I should say, were outstanding because they weren't even regular soldiers. The Fiji Infantry Regiment were equivalent to what you might call a British Territorial Army Battalion. They were only part-timers who were suddenly induced to do this two-year tour in Malaya to chase a few bandits just for a bit of fun, and how about volunteering chaps, and they all fell for it, and they were absolutely splendid. And they were very good at it, and they killed more bandits in their 2 years than most other battalions killed in perhaps 3 or 4 years. A pretty bloodthirsty lot, the Kijis, and they got going, and they were effective. They were very effective because they could do so many different things. If you had a ceremonial, like a Queen's birthday parade, they could dress up in the ceremonial they had of theirs, which is the scallop skirt and their red jackets, zouave jackets, scarlet jackets, no headdress, bare feet, but they're very smart. They could do that. They had quite a good band and a choir, a very good choir. They could, of course, beat anybody, beat the hide off anybody at Rugga. You know, the battalion team, I only talk about the battalion team, but the battalion could raise a 15 who could beat anybody in Malaya at Rugga. Not that there was that much opposition, I must say, but never mind, they were very good at Rugga. But when it came to their technique in the jungle, I think they were good because they were so strong. They tended to be big, strong men who could keep going. You may know that the general operation in the jungle of Malaya was really only incidental and a chance contact with the enemy. What would happen is you patrol, if you like mad in all directions, and you'd probably never see a communist terrorist. Then one day you'd probably, by chance, perhaps more than anything, stumble across a camp, a little camp of perhaps 15 or 20 communist terrorists, who'd be surprised. But they always had a drill. And their drill was that if anything like that happened, they were dispersed. They had a dispersal drill, so they all dispersed in different directions, so that you couldn't chase them all. Sort of thing. You might chase one or two, but you couldn't chase the lot. But the Fiji were remarkably good because they were so strong and they were so fit. They always had a man, so did the Gurkhas, that man, well, so did the British. But the man up front of any patrol was always the man with the Bren gun, the automatic, yes? With his safety catch off and his finger on the trigger, so that should, by any chance, have a bit of luck and you see anything moving, you could press the trigger and you might kill a bandit if you're lucky. The Fijis, in fact, I think excelled in a sense that if they had these chance encounters, the Fijis were so fleet of foot that they would actually outstrip the bandits. So when the bandits were sort of running in all directions, the Fijis could run even quicker. They sort of catch them and beat them down. So I think that's how they hyped up their numbers to some extent. I don't mean that the Gurkhas weren't good at it too, but the Gurkha little chap wasn't quite so quick or, quite so strong at following up. And the British wasn't quite in the same class, I have to say. They weren't quite that good. Whatever the regiment, they weren't quite that good at going flat out through the jungle somewhere, but on the whole they weren't quite in that class. So it's very interesting, but I could go on forever about the land situation. All I can say is, it was, from my point of view, it was a very... I had experience of Gurkhas, of course, in the White City and in the Chindits, but seeing them at closer hand in a way and working with them was a very enlivening experience to have, and I found they were wonderful people, very good officers.
What were your main problems as brigade major?
Well, brigade major, he is responsible for the operations.
Yes, but what were the main problems that you faced? In doing your job?
In doing my job? I think... if you're talking about organisation and that sort of thing, I don't think one had any problems. You had good communications, you had good transport, you had good Gurkha defence platoon around you. Everything was highly organized, supply, no problems. Nothing like being the Chindits where you had nothing and you had to make do. No, we were very well looked after, I think, in Malaya. The problems really were, I suppose, with the other side, in the sense that they were elusive. They were a ragtag sort of bunch who were difficult to catch up with. And they were difficult to, difficult to achieve, very difficult to chalk up any achievement. The only way you could clock up your, they had a sort of league table scores. Every battalion was saying, well, we've now killed 35 bandits, or we've killed 135, or whatever, the league table, of course. But conditions varied tremendously.